Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. Today's special guest is David Fleming. We are excited to speak to him about Ron Howard's Hillbilly Elegy. And David, thank you so much for being on the show. I had a really great time with both Hillbilly Elegy and The Score. Congratulations. It really hit me in the heart.
Oh, that's great to hear. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate you having me on.
Before we get into that and the many things that you have on your plate this year, let's start at the beginning. What got you into music? What did you hear that spurred your passion for composing and just taking you on this journey?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, starting out growing up in New York, I was always really into music and story connecting. Like, probably my earliest musical memory is wearing out the cassette tape for Phantom of the Opera that my family had. And, you know, from there, it was just, you know, I was always stealing my dad's records, but it would be ones like Bruce Springsteen or Meatloaf, ones that kind of had this bigger scope, more of this sort of dramatic cinematic feel. And then all through high school, you know, playing in bands at the same time, I was working in a video store when those still existed. And just immersing myself in movies all day. It was sort of like the Tarantino film school in a way. And it just became something that I started to realize was this really potent chemistry when you get the right image and the right music. And it was something I started paying a lot more attention to. The thing that started off for me was one of my best friends was doing this school project it was like a create your own movie trailer, and she asked me to score it, and it was just like a light went off. You know, playing in bands, there's this kind of moment where you're playing with other musicians and maybe things aren't clicking quite right, and then all of a sudden there's always this moment where things just click, and it's just this kind of amazing feeling. And for me, you know, figuring out the right image, you know, the right picture, or the right music to go with the right image, kind of has the same feel. It's just got this, it's just this great feeling of just seeing something click and work better than it could in its separate parts.
Maybe you're kind of paraphrasing Roy Tin Cup McAvoy. Or did you get a ringing in your loins when you put the perfect note to the perfect picture? What's the feeling? Describe that.
No, it's the only thing I can compare it to is that feeling of playing with other musicians. There's a certain electricity. It's hard to argue with it. Of course, you can analyze choices when talking about music and film, and you could have done this or hey, have you tried this? But there is a kind of electricity about finding something that just feels objectively right, and usually when you have that feeling, other people have that feeling too. So it's not really something that I could explain other than to say it's just a feeling that something's right, and all of a sudden maybe the scene or these images that you've seen countless times have something new to them or feel three-dimensional in a way they didn't before.
Gotcha.
It's a great feeling, and you're always chasing that dragon.
Well, working at the video store, I'm sure you have some behind-the-counter recommendations, things that were sort of under the radar, off the beaten path.
Oh, okay. Well, my video store, it was funny because it was one of these places where it's just one single employee. It wasn't a Blockbuster where it was like a little mom and pop shop. So you know, unlike those places where you just had to play trailers, you could basically put on whatever you wanted. There were rules in place. You're not supposed to play rated R movies, but you know, if it was a slow day, and it often was a slow day, you know, you could put in all sorts of things. I discovered Terrence Malick films when I was at the video store. I remember watching Straw Dogs for the first time and having to turn it off and on every time customers came in and just, have some sort of family film at the ready.
Sure.
But it was just, the perks of it being a slow video store was basically all through high school. It was just digging into that library and not even, not even at first to research film music or think about that specifically, but just to kind of build these reference points, kind of develop my own tastes.
So, moving from, interest in movies and scoring that short film, what about the short film really got you motivated, or like what was that the high point in that process for you?
It's funny, I haven't thought about that short film for a while, but the director for that is this really great stop motion animator, Haley Morris, who I grew up with, and she's actually the granddaughter of John Morris, who's this legendary film composer, that did the film scores for Mel Brooks and
Spaceballs,
And A Young Frankenstein, just brilliant composer. And I didn't think about that at the time, but it must have been somewhere in my mind that okay, I've just done this, and someone in her family, has done this as a profession, and it just started clicking and coming together and being something that I was interested in, and started, researching more and thinking about moving forward with it as a career. But to be honest, if I'm really honest, there wasn't a thought out path. It was more like this thing just started calling me and I just started following it. So, but even when I was playing in bands, I was writing fairly cinematically, I would say. Everything was always written at the piano. Things were constantly revolving around, big stories. We'd be playing these punk and hardcore shows, and we'd have concept album material. It was very, very, very geeky, but everyone seemed to be all right with it. And, it's just always trying to find a way to express, what ultimately is my main love, which is storytelling, and music is kind of my in with that. So after that, it was just following those instincts.
Did any of your band members or friends have similar interests who kind of maybe spurred you on and helped you with your creative path?
No one had similar interests, but I think everyone, it's really helpful to be part of an encouraging community. And I would say that with, growing up playing music, but also even now at Remote Control, being around a community of other people who make music, even if they don't identify necessarily with what you are doing, if they're encouraging and kind of like and support when you do something that sounds like you, rather than maybe, trying to figure out what other people want to hear, I think that encouragement can go a long way to at least, building some sort of confidence to tackle whatever it is next. So for me, even though no one really could identify with that particular calling, everyone in my life was really supportive of me doing it. And even if they weren't, I don't know. It helped, but when I look back at going into music, it seems like such a foolhardy endeavor. I mean, I remember my first day of music school, my teacher basically being like, except for dance, this is probably the worst career decision you could have all made. And I just want to make that clear on day one. It's not something that you can really plan. It's just something that if it feels right, you got to follow it, and that's what I did.
Gotcha. Well, I was watching something last night about the making of Tim Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas, and they kind of went into how he was sort of the weirdo in the Disney bunch, and you know, he found people like Henry Selick and the stop animator who kind of made everything, you know, matriculate or come to life. And it's, you're right, if even if everybody says no to you or closes doors, as long as you start to, you know, believe in yourself and find these people who can help you, I mean, you know, paths pretty much limitless. But that sounds like a great confidence inspiring speech from your teacher. So,
well, it's funny how you can be motivated by hearing things like that too. Cause in a way it was, okay, this is on me. This is a serious endeavor. This isn't, you know, a place where I can afford to coast. You know, it's something that you got to be proactive with. And if it's something that you're passionate about, this sort of, you know, that will come naturally, or at least it did for me. And then, you know, you do find different people along the way who are encouraging and kind of keep that going. I mean, Mike Post, sort of the next step in my journey was I'd won this BMI fellowship, which brought me out to Los Angeles to work with Mike Post for 6 weeks. It's this Pete Carpenter fellowship for young composers. And he was, you know, this is when I was still living in New York. He was incredibly encouraging and kind of just, you know, just him sort of looking me in the eyes and saying, you should be out here, just come out. You'll figure it out once you get out here, you know, be ready to not get a music job, you know, be ready to not work in music for a year or so, but just move out. This is where you belong. And so, you know, sometimes positive reinforcement works, sometimes negative reinforcement works. It's all about how you use those little pieces of fuel, I think.
Totally. Well, you know, the thing that I always, there's something that I've learned by speaking to a lot of composers, and even when I tried to play music myself, you know, before you find your voice, you try to emulate other people, and it teaches you things that you don't know, and you kind of, you learn through osmosis, so to speak. So I guess where in the process do you feel like you were making David Fleming music and not just, you know, helping somebody else's vision or you know, like working with Mike Post per se, you know? What's the point where you felt like this was, yes, now I'm making me?
Well, it's, you know, you mentioned the Mike Post thing. For that small experience, which was really, you know, a sort of a favor he does for young composers, you know, there's sort of a portion of it where you're supposed to write a Law and Order episode alongside him or sort of simultaneously. And then at the end, you show him what you've done and he looks, you know, and he shows you what he's done, and he kind of tells you what could be better. And then a separate section where you kind of write your own music. He gives you these ideas of theme songs and things like that, and you go off. And you know, I was so much more successful with the stuff that sounded like me. And so for me, it's actually been a little bit of the opposite, which is I think growing up and sort of in those early years, working for other composers, I had a harder time sort of writing in somebody else's style and, you know, kind of only knew how to do what I did. And actually when I was able to relax and realize that I could actually learn a lot from some, you know, sort of seeing someone else's vision and kind of, you know, seeing what I could glean from that. That's actually when I started strengthening my own voice even more, I think, through work with guys like Otley and Steve Jablonski and now Hans. You know, sitting, the thing about being a good musician is really more listening than anything, and getting to listen you know, to music and just hearing about their approach from all of these different composers that I've worked with has actually, I think, sharpened my own identity of what I do. because you sort of see different things that different people do and are, you know, you're drawn to what your taste draws you to, and you leave out what maybe you're not drawn to. So I feel like in some ways I learned that backwards, but it's been more helpful in the long run having done it.
No, that's awesome. And you know, you mentioned Steve Jablonski, and I feel like over the many years that I've been covering this site, I've had the roundabout Hans Zimmer interview where I've spoken to Harry Gregson Williams and Benjamin Wallfisch and Steve Jablonski and Penka Kuneva. So now I'm glad to be speaking with you, and you mentioned remote control earlier. So how was that connection made, and what opened the door?
Yeah, well, remote control is funny because that, you know, even when I was back in New York working a safety job, designing fire sprinkler systems, which I was terrible, terrible at. I was, you know, using my free time to learn more about film composing, and remote control was somewhere that I was always interested in ending up. I had no idea how that would happen, but it was like, oh, I'd really love to go there. I mean, I'd heard about this kind of campus idea of having this community of film composers, and then it just happened very randomly, you know, through Mike Post. He introduced me to Atli Orvarsson, who Icelandic, you know, great Icelandic composer, yeah, who had actually won the same fellowship 11 years previous to me, and right around that time, Atli was needing help, and he was at that time at Remote Control Productions. So I basically, you know, stepped into this assistant job with Atli at the place I always wanted to end up. It seemed like coincidence, but at the same time, you know, remote control does seem to have a gravitational pull, and like you said, so many people have kind of, you know, frequented those halls and I know what you mean. I feel like even before I worked with Hans, I also felt like I was sort of absorbing a lot of information about him and his process through all these other guys.
Well, if we can go back a step to even before the video store and back when you listened to Meatloaf, what were some of the scores that, whether you paid complete attention to it or not, really just spoke to you, and then you found yourself going back 2 years later going, wow, I remember that, and that's, you know, it means something to me now. I mean, do you have any yeah, experiences like that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, John Williams, obviously, specifically the third Indiana Jones, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, I remember that maybe being the first time I really took stock of the film music. I think that was the first one I had seen. I saw that before I'd seen Raiders, and okay, I was obsessed with it. And even now to this day, there's this piece for the motorcycle chase that he wrote that I appreciate it now in such a different way, having, you know, now that this is my career, but it's so deeply ingrained in my childhood subconscious. So, you know, things like that. I mean, yeah, Star Wars, obviously. I mean, The Lion King was such a touchstone for me, which was crazy to, you know, come full circle years later and get to work with Hans on the remake, because I think that was the first CD my family owned, and that was a really big deal. So, you know, and oftentimes, like you said, it's going back and refinding those things, and you know, sometimes you can kind of identify, oh, this is why I like that. I can kind of analyze it, but then there's other times where you're just, you know, something just feels magical and you almost don't want to analyze it because you don't want to spoil whatever it is about it that touched you when you were young.
Yeah. It's like when you go to the symphony, you're so enamored by what you hear on a record or a CD, and then you see a guy in the second row going, Oh, that's all? I thought that was, you know, alchemy or however they created that weird sound.
Yeah, it's funny, even with pop songs, if I'll find myself really gravitating towards a song and kind of being obsessed with it, and then finally sitting down at the piano to work it out. And I figured, it's these chords right here that are making me feel that way. And strangely, sometimes that I'll still love the song, but the intrigue that it was generating is gone a little bit. I mean, there's a new appreciation that replaces that mystery, but there's usually something behind it. There's usually something that is making your brain say, oh, that's good. I want to hear that again.
Well, you know, speaking more to the idea of you making the music that is really you. And I mean, somebody will come to David Fleming when they want your style of music, not to say, I want a score made of marimbas or whatever. But as far as doing things that are in your, I guess, musical tastes versus being outside of your comfort zone, what are things that you've been asked to do that might have been a stretch for you that you maybe thought I wouldn't have been asked if I was still designing fire control systems?
Right. Well, I mean, quite a few of the projects that I've been on felt like stretches at the time. And that's always, of course, terrifying, but it's usually where, you know, by the end of it, you feel really satisfied because you have stretched this muscle or maybe, you know, formed a muscle that you didn't have before. I remember on Blue Planet, when I was brought onto that with Hans and Jacob Shea, I was, you know, really excited to do it and was looking forward to the challenge. But it became apparent watching the first episode that some of the scenes almost had an animation feel to it. Like this kind of what we call Mickey Mousing, where you're scoring sort of every single motion that might be in a scene, and it had this quality to it which was of an animated film, which was something I hadn't attempted and wasn't particularly drawn to before that. So it was one of those things where of course the first thing you think is, can I do this? But then as soon as you start and you start figuring out, it became such a fun, I don't want to say exercise because I feel like we executed, on a pretty decent level, but it had that kind of quality of simultaneous research, trying to figure out, how would an animation score this? I mean, I know it's live action, but if this was a cartoon turtle, you know, how would this work? Why do we do this certain move here and why there? And then also kind of finding your own way of doing it, because I think, you know, I'm not particularly interested in repeating tropes necessarily. It's more about finding which ones work, why do they work, and then how can we make this something that's a little more interesting than you know, serviceable and average. So it's always a fun experiment. I love getting new things. It's actually one of the things that's most fun about this job, I think, as opposed to being a recording artist, is because sometimes you have to put on a hat that no one maybe expects that you have or would be surprised to find that you're enthusiastic about it or want to learn about it. So it's a really great sort of career if you love jumping into the deep end.
But also in a deep end where plenty of other people have swam and there's only so many notes, do you ever get in a situation? I mean, I imagine it's like cooking, like how many ways can you make a sandwich? So you ever beat yourself up or beat your head against the wall trying to, you know, nail a cue, whether it is, Mickey Mouse or a suite or something, and just go, I just don't know how to do this? You know, where do you turn when you are troubled?
Yeah, you beat your head against the wall. Like, okay. Yeah, you have that feeling all the time. I think even Hans would say he has that feeling, so it's, but usually what I try to remember is that I do have the feeling all the time. So every time you have the feeling, this has happened hundreds of times before and you always figure it out. And usually you're having that really frustrating feeling right before you do figure it out. So, you know, sometimes I'll go take a walk or, walk my dog or honestly, like sometimes just watching a couple YouTube videos kind of clears out the cobwebs, even if they're totally unrelated. I remember one thing I always loved, I love the show Mad Men. And there's one episode I remember early on where Don is struggling to get ideas and he's really blocked, and he ends up, I think, going to the movies in the middle of the day, taking a nap. Everyone is furious at him. Where's the idea? And then he wakes up and it seemingly just pops into his head. I don't think that's a good method. I wouldn't suggest that, and I definitely wouldn't do that. But at the same time, there is something to be said for trusting that you'll find something and giving yourself a little bit of breathing room to do it. And then, of course, there's just the pure panic of deadlines, and ultimately, what we have to do as film composers is produce on command. So you have to kind of balance it out. You can't just wait.
One of the things that I saw in your resume is a score produced by. So can you break it down into layman's terms? What goes into producing something and what does that all entail?
So was that which was that for? That was Dark Phoenix, I think. Right?
Yeah, it was. It was the X-Men Dark Phoenix, yeah. Yes.
I mean, what, you know, all, basically what we do all the time is some mixture of composing and producing. I think on that particular project, Hans always talks about, you know, being in a band, and when we make music together, it should feel like being in a band. And there are some projects where that feels even more true for some reason. And on that particular one, it did feel like that we had a really long time to experiment. I mean, even after the movie came out, Hans decided to release an album called Experiments because we had like 14 hours of music and you know, no outlet for all this stuff. So I think really it's all the same thing. It's just, to what extent are you are you sort of playing together in a band like this? And in that particular case, that was just, it was basically the longest playground I think any of us had ever had because of the nature of the film being delayed a few times and also us just having fun. So, you know, producing has this connotation of really hard work, but honestly, you know, what we do when it's working right and when it's the best, it doesn't feel like producing. It feels like, you know, you're playing and you're creating something together, and hopefully producing is just another word for being creative.
Okay. And so that stops at the creative process. It doesn't go into distributing or packaging or anything like
that. Oh, God, labels. No. Everyone would be in terrible trouble if I think musicians were in charge of the things like that. No,
okay, just want to confirm.
No, nothing like that. No, we weren't packing albums in our rooms. Thankfully we have really great team at Remote Control, a non-musical team as well, who help facilitate all those things, and luckily we only have to concentrate on making music, because otherwise people would be in trouble.
All right. So Hillbilly Elegy is an Imagine Entertainment picture directed by Ron Howard, produced by Ron Grazer. Those guys go everywhere together. So you're tag teaming with Hans on this. Ron and Brian are on the creative end. Do you all four get together in a room? How much interaction happens? And like, who takes the lead on the score?
Yeah, well, I mean, as far as us all being in a room, that changed throughout the process, because at the very, you know, we started pre-COVID back in November, I think, or December. And so, you know, we could all be in a room together, and the great thing about those early kinds of meetings with Hans is it's really like an open forum, and let's shoot ideas back and forth. Let's bring up YouTube videos. That's always a fun part of the process, you know, just going down rabbit holes of music and conversation and just letting yourself kind of be led by the conversation rather than, you know, try to speak in minutiae and specifics. And then of course, you know, as the process developed, the circumstances changed so drastically. So we ended up communicating all on Zoom together from our separate homes. Ron was in New York, and most of his team was in New York. And Hans and I were out here in Los Angeles, obviously, and our music editors. So we did, you know, a huge amount of the score over Zoom, and even, you know, Hans and I attended the entire final mix of the film every day on Zoom during the dub.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, I mean, the great thing, you know, I had always heard how great Ron was to work with, and obviously Hans and Ron have this amazing history of making these films together. But one thing I was so pleasantly surprised at, especially being kind of a newcomer to this relationship, was how open a collaborator Ron was. And I already knew that about Hans, but Ron just really, you know, he treats everybody in the room like a filmmaker on equal footing. Of course, he has the final say at the end of the day, but he is really open to ideas and wants to hear everyone's thoughts about, you know, even non-musical things. I mean, he obviously trusts Hans implicitly, but trusts him as a filmmaker, not just a musician. So that was a really, you know, especially at the beginning of lockdown, everyone being sort of confined to their separate physical realities, it felt really good to be able to have this open connection, because it, you know, it could have been a different experience if it wasn't such a collaborative process and we still had to be working remotely, but it was completely the opposite of that.
No, that's great, because the antithesis of that is too many cooks in the kitchen and you just get this hodgepodge of things. But no, it's that sounds like an awesome experience. I wish I could be a fly on the wall for some of those Zoom meetings.
And you know, it's still a Ron film at the end of the day. It's never too many cooks in the kitchen. It's not people trying to talk over each other or anything. It's really just a respect for other people's opinions and judgments. But at the end of the day, Ron always had his vision about how this film, you know, should feel. And you know, I think the key for all of us was you know, keying into his vision and then just, you know, trying to help him achieve it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the film has incredible heart, and which really speaks to, like you said, it is a Ron Howard film. You know, Rush, Backdraft, these movies that have some intense moments, but also have a lot of character and depth to them. The score, you know, goes without saying, it toes the line it needs to. What were some of your favorite tracks, and what were some of the standout instruments that you were happy to have composed this with?
Let me start with the instruments thing, because that's kind of an interesting part of this whole process. Because right from the very beginning, you know, obviously this is, you know, this is a story that revolves around this region of Appalachia, and, you know, which has this really rich, beautiful musical culture that, you know, that you could really get lost in. But at the same time, you know, JD, the main character, is a 90s kid, and you know, Ron early on was sort of, a lot of the conversations revolved around, okay, how regional are we going to be here? You know, we don't want to make a caricature out of this culture and this family. So, you know, even specifics like, are we going to use banjo, you know, and what we ended up settling on, I think, was called banjo adjacent, which is just, you know, it should sound like there's a banjo somewhere nearby, but no one actually goes and picks it up. But, you know, while we were sort of having these conversations about minutia and fiddle and banjo, Hans at one point, I remember, sort of cut through it and said, you know, it's not about that. This is an emotional epic. Their journey is, you know, that could be any family's journey. It could be someone in the UK or wherever. It's not the most important thing. The most important thing is we tell this family story, because they have this journey that spans these generations. And so from that point on, it became less about what instruments we're using and more about what describes what this family is going through and what players could help us describe that. So for instance, early on, we had Ben Powell, who's this great violinist. He sat in for the meetings and kind of jammed with us. And he's a really interesting character, because he's this classically trained guy from London, but has this deep reverence and affinity for Appalachian music. And, you know, having hit someone like him early on was so helpful to, you know, because the score needed to be organic and kind of, you know, feel a bit homespun. And then towards the end of the project, when we were all locked down in quarantine, I remember maybe it was even the first weekend where it was pretty obvious that we were going to have to dash our plans to record with a, you know, a traditional orchestra. And, you know, sort of wrapping our head around the process and logistics, I remember Hans called me up on maybe that first Saturday night, and we were thinking about guitar players, and he said, well, what if we get Derek Trucks? And if you don't know Derek Trucks, he's like one of the world's great slide guitar players. He you know, has an Allman Brothers pedigree, and he has a band with his wife, the Tedeschi Trucks band, that's just incredible. And you know, he's somebody who's normally a very busy touring musician. And, you know, the one, I guess, silver lining of this whole COVID situation is, you know, the flip side of all of, you know, of how horrible it is that all these musicians aren't able to tour, you know, they're open to doing things like this, to playing guitar on a film scoring project. And he couldn't have been more enthusiastic and grateful, and we were just amazingly lucky, and felt amazingly lucky to have him play, because this guy is just, I could go on about Derek for a really long time, but he's, you know, the thing about musicians is all the musicians we work with are fantastic. And, you know, sometimes you'll record musicians and they'll have multiple takes and oh, that was really great here, and this was great, and we'll put something together. And Derek would play these solos over our cues that each one was this like uniquely beautiful gem. And it ended up being, the problem ended up being that we couldn't pick, like everything was so great. We could make probably four more scores with all of the solos that he sent over, including some really out there stuff that we couldn't use, but it broke my heart. We had sent him this one piece that was sort of tension music. And he, Derek, in addition to being this brilliant blues player, has this classical Indian background he's got a knowledge of classical Indian music, and he ripped these solos that were like Jimmy Page on acid, kind of Kashmir-esque, just really beautiful, beautiful harmonic solos. And so, yeah, I mean, it's interesting how the circumstances this year have presented really interesting, opportunities for us. And in the end, I think the score was better for featuring solo voices rather than, a more anonymous orchestral voice.
Well, it kind of goes without saying, but even some things that weren't voices, like there was in the track Suffocating, there was some breathing, and then there was some percussion and what sounded like some stomps. So there were some elements of the score which were, I would say, non-traditional, just because they were foreign to me, but they almost seemed like they were very literal and on the nose. So what went into some of those discussions to kind of, I mean, you know, when you have breathing in a track called Suffocating, that, like I said, it seems very literal. So,
Well, I think probably that the title came after,
I
think that's sort of evoked that feeling. There's a lot of times during the film where JD is sort of dealing with his own anger and kind of, his journey as a character is to try to break this cycle that he's seen his mother go through, and in some ways his grandmother go through. And I think his feelings about his family, although he's got this deep love for them, always sort of gets kind of mixed up with this feeling of claustrophobia, where he feels drawn into this kind of tractor beam and on his way back there. But as far as the instrumentation itself, I mean, the breathing was this great vocalist named Loire, who has worked with Hans on a number of projects, including Dark Phoenix. And she was recording something at the time, and we were messing around with that track, and he grabbed her, brought her into the room. I mean, things like the percussion in that track were inspired. Oh, and I should backtrack a little bit. The breathing is actually a bit inspired by a type of Appalachian singing. You know, we listen to a lot of sacred harp singing, and our brilliant vocal contractor Edie kind of talked about this style of rhythmic breathing that we could use to add to the track. And then the percussion was really informed by this style of hillbilly tap dancing that I was aware of, that emanating more from West Virginia. But it's this kind of rhythmic, gritty percussive sound. So so that those kinds of, even if it was just watching a couple of YouTube videos, immersing yourself just enough to kind of get a feel of the DNA and not try to be literal with the way this, because we could never live a lifetime and possibly reflect the entire history of this culture's music. But it's more just finding these flavors and these things that seem to express something to JD about his home, because really, as a character, he's so conflicted about breaking out and making something for himself versus getting drawn back into what he feels are these cycles of pain that the family seems to not be able to snap out of themselves.
And the pain of watching it as an observer or somewhat a Netflix subscriber is that watching Amy Adams turn on a dime to where she's one way and then she completely flips. And so I wonder, was that difficult for you to try to, you know, score a character who was such a wild card, or did it go into any of your mindset on how to lay an acoustic blanket over?
It absolutely did, because the thing about her, and you know, JD talks about this in real life and in his book, that there was always kind of this sense of uneasiness around her because she had these violent episodes, like that episode with where she sort of attacks him in the car and he feels like almost kills her. To this day, Ron says that JD has a hard time watching that scene because it was such a traumatic event in his life. And then at the same time, you see, and I think Amy does a really amazing job of this, you see how tender she can be and how she's always trying to kind of bridge that gap between her and her son. So musically, you know, one thing that we came up with early on was this idea of having this sort of simple two-note motif. The thing about these two notes is that they're anonymous enough that you can turn them dark on a dime. They can feel really tender, but you know, they always have this hint that, you know, there could be something dark right around the corner that she could turn if you just say the wrong thing to her about one of her new boyfriends or you know, about the pills that she's taking, that she always has this potential for violence all the time, even when she's being sweet. So I think the important thing with her was A, stay out of the way, because she's, you know, both with her and Glenn, there's so much that they're doing that you don't always need to underline it. You know, their performances are so nuanced. But at the same time, you want to kind of accentuate that thing that JD's feeling, that dread. It's like, do you want to pet the dog again, even though it's bitten you and you love, you know, it's that mix between love and dread that I think makes her a really interesting character.
Well, you know, you said something a second ago, which was JD's sort of MO to stay out of the way. One of the most pivotal scenes in the movie is when young JD is having a discussion with his grandmother in the car after he throws out the calculator.
Yeah.
And there's no music.
Yes.
So I remember hearing Hans talk about his efforts to score 12 Years a Slave, and he said the smartest thing he could have done was stay out of the way of the story.
Yeah.
So how did you choose when not to have music? What made it right to be quiet?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Hans said about that film was true about our approach to this film as well. And that scene in particular, there was a discussion at one point, I remember, do we have music in this? And I think both Hans and I felt, no way, don't touch it. It's so, that scene's just heartbreaking. I feel like I had a similar scene with my grandma at some point growing up, you know, or a parent, you know, that moment where someone kind of really tells you, stop messing up, you know? It's a constant, you know, to answer your question more directly, it's a constant discussion, and it's constantly seeing what works. Let's throw something at it. Hey, you know, there's plenty of scenes that maybe had music originally and we took it out, or didn't have music when they first presented the cut, and we found something, some connective tissue. It's always the most, you know, in some ways, the most important part of the process is going through and spotting the film with the director and just having conversations. Here's why I think we need music here. And oftentimes Hans or I will say, well, actually, you know, if have you thought about, rather than scoring this scene and then this flashback scene separately, why don't we bridge these, which ended up being something that we figured out very early on. Like, let's not score the two time periods as separate. Let's let's use music to bridge these gaps because time is jumping all the time. And the truth is that JD, even when he's older and in New Haven, he, you know, as soon as he gets a call that's his mother's number, he is immediately back there. It's not like he needs to think about growing up. He is constantly kind of reliving these memories every time he interacts with his family. So, you know, for us, music became a tool of how do we, you know, communicate that JD is basically always locked in this mindset of he just doesn't want to get trapped in those same cycles, and yet he can't seem to escape. Nor does he, in some ways, nor does he want to, because there is this deep familial bond at the bottom of all of it.
And it's weird to, you know, for a movie like this, even though the book came out previous to it, for a movie about family to come out in a year with COVID, I think that your family's all you got. And I think that's what Glenn Close's character, you know, was her point. So, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You get a movie like this and everybody's got their problems, but if we can come together as a family, it's this is the year for it. So why not this movie? So,
yeah, sure. No, I agree. I think, you know, it was Thanksgiving, I thought was a nice time to bring it out. You know, even though obviously these people go through, you know, such horrible struggles with drug addiction and poverty. And at the same time, there's, yeah, you basically exactly what you said. It's you really have to take stock. And I think in the movie, JD, you can really see him eventually kind of accept this part of himself as Vance, as part of this generational journey, but also sort of move on and move to the next step as his own man. And, you know, you were asking about, you know, particular cues earlier that might have stood out. I think for me the last cue in the film, which I think on the soundtrack I think is called "Steel in Our Veins," is really powerful for me, because it is that culmination of his journey and kind of, you know, we get to harken back to music that we used when he's in Kentucky as a kid, having these kind of idyllic summers, and it's really him accepting the best parts of himself as a Vance and still sort of moving on. It's also the place in the film where we really get to unleash Derek Trucks. He just rips this insane solo at the end. Some people even think it's vocals, because he's got this just incredible tone. I do think what it has to say about family, you know, I think who can argue with that?
Well, thank you again for such, you know, contributing such an amazing score and your band membership with Hans to make this movie sing. Real quick sidestep. So you mentioned the last track, "Steel in Your Veins." Can we talk about another type of steel? A little cold blue steel. A little bit of Mighty Wings, maybe Top Gun. What's happening with that?
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Right. Sorry, you lost
me. Two on the nose.
Well, blue steel. I went to Zoolander there for a second. yeah. That also something that got finished during quarantine, I think. It's coming out next year. Got to also be in the band for that one, and you know, Wonder Woman's around the corner. Lots of fun stuff. Dune next year. That's another one I'm really excited about. So. Yeah, I mean, you know, the fantastic thing was, you know, during this year where I feel very lucky to have gotten to work on all these amazing projects.
Well, it seems like your star is consistently on the rise. I hope to speak to you about those three titles you dropped. I think I'm more partial to Top Gun than the other two, but I would love to just spend another hour with you. So maybe we could line it up in 2021.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate your time.